Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both the Saturday Show and the Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
Tonight on All In, 25 years of division and anger.
Why can't he produce a birth certificate?
Deep-seated hatred for white people or the white culture.
The strategy is to change the demographics of the country.
I'm more angry about it than you are.
Tonight, the undeniable evidence that Fox News is the real source of America's rising rage.
You think we're bad for America? You think I'm bad for America?
Yeah.
Then, what we know about what's being turned over as the White House denies Donald Trump's request to keep his record secret. And the January 6th committee promises action to compel people to talk. Plus, as one senator worries about the silence of the chickens.
One or the other was going to turn, or you were going to have a lot of dead chickens.
What to make of today's rough job numbers with Jared Bernstein, and why on earth is the rental market getting out of control? But All In starts right now. Good evening from New York. I'm Chris Hayes. You've probably seen these viral videos that have been going around. Maybe not, but there's been a lot of them, of people losing their minds at school board meetings. You might have seen this particularly egregious video. It's of a woman berating a mother because the mom's kid was wearing a mask.
He's going to be traumatized because you put that mask on him. You don't let him breathe through it. You're traumatized.
That's my choice. Yeah, well, that's my choice. Yeah, you better respect my choice.
No, no. You're a propaganda. You're not being told the truth.
Now, this is, to put it mildly, incredibly antisocial behavior, just wildly outside the parameters of everything, anything you would want or expect in civil society. You think to yourself, well, where would someone even get the idea to do something like that? Well, we have an answer.
As for forcing children to wear masks outside, that should be illegal. Your response when you see children wearing masks as they play should be no different from your response to seeing someone beat a kid in Walmart. Call the police immediately. Contact Child Protective Services. Keep calling until someone arrives. What you're looking at is abuse. It's child abuse, and you are morally obligated to attempt to prevent it.
There is a direct pipeline from what appears on Fox News to the absolute worst manifestations, worst behavior, worst elements of our politics and society. Input to output. Clear and strong connection. Just take a step back and survey the wreckage of the current moment, this unprecedented era in American politics. The first president in the country's history without any meaningful political or military experience. The first president impeached twice. The first deadly insurrection, which tried to interrupt the peaceful transfer of power and overthrew the duly elected government since basically the cannons firing Fort Sumter during the Civil War. We have experienced all of that. These genuinely novel, unprecedented, destructive events in just a few years. How did we get here? The answer is in large part Fox News. And so it is fitting that on the network's 25th anniversary, as they are patting themselves in the back amid all the pomp and circumstance, Donald Trump, the monster they created, both an avid Fox News viewer and the network's quintessential talking head, the real-life case study of what happens when you try to govern the country based on the network's cynical and demagogic misinformation, that he was who they chose to have on to complete the circle. The logical conclusion of Fox's quarter-century-long project to rebuild the United States in its image. It was exactly the kind of sycophantic propaganda you would expect from Fox. Not even a pretense of asking Trump a tough question about, say, a new report that implicated him in an attempted coup. Instead, we got the same disgusting, vile, racist attacks on immigrants that have become Fox News's brand over the past two decades. And it was almost fitting. Because Donald Trump, the politician, and his racism and nativism, authoritarian aspirations, almost entirely a creation of Fox News. And the political project that its founding CEO, Roger Ailes, first set out to make half a century ago. When he pitched then-President Richard Nixon on a news network that would beam pro-Republican coverage directly into Americans' homes every night. Trump's presidency was the apotheosis of Ailes' vision for the country. The country we now have, which is being torn to shreds in the midst of a democratic crisis and a deadly once-in-a-century pandemic, which is so much deadlier than it needs to be, in large part because of what Fox is putting out every night. There is a body count there. Fox's corrosion of our discourse may be reaching a crescendo now, but there's a great piece in Mother Jones that makes a compelling case the network's debut 25 years ago, 1996, was the point that started to push this country on its current trajectory of heightened polarization and distrust of major institutions. From the insane spectacle of the Clinton impeachment in the late 1990s to the 2000 presidential election between George W. Bush and Al Gore, which Gore won the popular vote of, its chaotic aftermath to the racist, destructive culture war madness of the post-9/11 era and the lead up to the Iraq War, when the country band, then known as the Dixie Chicks, were essentially removed from polite society for daring to criticize then-President George W. Bush, and the House of Representatives cafeterias started serving, quote, freedom fries to protest France's opposition to the Iraq War. And of course, the war itself, which was touted as a huge success on the network, while its critics, who were, of course, ultimately vindicated by history, were lambasted for their lack of patriotism. To the racialized backlash to Barack Obama's presidency, including birtherism, the racist conspiracy theory that says Obama was not born in this country, which was Donald Trump's first major foray into the political discourse. And that set the groundwork for the entire MAGA movement. All this was fueled by Fox News and the perpetual conservative outrage machine. And it's not just speculation. There's been studies done of this. There are studies that have determined that Fox News is a real motivating factor in American politics. One study found that Fox's impact increased Republicans' vote share in presidential elections by 3 to 4 points. In a country as polarized as ours, that is enough to be massively consequential. I mean, for reference, Republicans have won the popular vote exactly once since the 1980s. In 2004, George W. Bush did win an outright majority of voters. But according to this study, if it was not for the boost from Fox News, that outcome would have been reversed. And it's not just voters. Republican politicians basically live in fear of Fox, the backlash it could inspire. In his memoir, former Republican Speaker of the House John Boehner writes about that destructive influence that it had on his party. He recounts going to confront then-chairman of the network, Roger Ailes, about Fox's coverage. Quote, I once met him in New York during the Obama years to plead with him to put a leash on some of the crazies he was putting on the air. It was making my job trying to accomplish anything conservative that much harder. Boehner goes on to say that Ailes was not receptive to his request. Ailes was a true believer through and through. He was not just cynically manipulating right-wing outrage and conspiracy theories about Obama and the Clintons. Roger Ailes believed it all too, or at least he did by that point. And he weaponized an entire conservative media empire to broadcast that pathological paranoia. At least until he was forced out of the network he built when more than 20 women, including high-profile Fox anchors, accused him of sexual harassment. He died shortly thereafter. And so it is true that, to a certain extent, Fox operates as state-run TV for elected Republicans. Just listen to former Trump press secretary Stephanie Grisham describe the relationship.
What was the role of Fox News in the White House?
That's just where we went to get what we wanted out. They, you know, by and large, didn't get tough with us. They just took what we were saying and disseminated it.
Elected Republicans obviously use Fox to disseminate pro-party propaganda. But we also cannot ignore the reverse wag the dog reality, where increasingly Republican politicians are themselves avid Fox viewers. That's where they get their information. They follow the network's lead. Kevin Drum highlights one example of Fox leading the party in that great Mother Jones piece. Quote, starting in March, Fox mentioned critical race theory 1,300 times in the space of just 3 months. By the end of June, 26 states had introduced legislation that restricted or banned teaching CRT and related topics. All this, of course, brings us back to our present moment, where every day, as we continue to chronicle on this show, Fox News is pushing out a constant stream of public health misinformation that is getting people sick, getting them into the hospital, getting them killed, and prolonging this pandemic. It's unconscionably dark. It's the darkest, most extreme logical conclusion you can imagine for where this entire enterprise would end up, where you've got these phenomenally rich, cosseted elite Fox hosts sitting in their little studios under the lights with hair and makeup and expensive clothes, working for a company that mandates either vaccines or daily testing regime, precisely the policy they're railing against. But they won't say that. They won't say anything about their bosses because they're too cowardly. Instead, what they're doing is pushing poison into people's brains that gets them sick. This is where both the modern enterprise of Fox News and the conservative movement more broadly have ended up. The most acute threat to American democracy we have seen in 150 years. So, happy 25th anniversary, guys. You did it. I want to bring in two people who have been studying the detrimental effect of Fox News for years. Joan Walsh, national affairs correspondent for The Nation, where she's written about the damaging impact Fox has on our nation's health. And Eric Bollert, a former senior fellow at Media Matters and founder and editor of PressRun.media, where he monitors right-wing propaganda in the post-Trump world. Eric, let me start with you. And there's an important point here about the landscape of American politics, which is people that are watching this show right now most likely consume a lot of different media from a lot of different places. They maybe listen to NPR, they read a bunch of newspapers, and we've got Pew data to back this up, right? So if you're talking about Democrats, like, here are things used by at least one third of Democrats: ABC News, CBS News, CNN, MSNBC, NBC News. Republicans, it's just Fox. Like, basically 40% of the country, there is a monopoly of information on those folks.
Yeah, I mean, it's one-stop shopping. Yes, there's OAN. Yes, there's Newsmax. Yes, they've splintered off even farther right. But when you talk about propaganda, it's so much more effective if there's only one place to go. And Fox News has created that. Look, the history you gave was dead on. You hit all the key points, the recount, the 9/11, the war in Iraq. And when Stephanie Grisham talks about, well, we go on Fox News and they don't ask us tough questions. They're the propaganda for the GOP. To me, that's kind of Fox News circa 2014. What you described, what this country is now facing with the pandemic, which has revealed and both broken these people, is beyond description. Fox News has killed. We'll never know how many people Fox News killed. Off the top of my head, 100,000, I think, is a reasonable estimate. And we've all talked about it being a cult, it being brainwashing, and people used to shake their heads. Oh, you can't talk about the media when talk about brainwashing. It's just a conservative outlet. It's brainwashing, and it's a cult because lives are now at stake. This is not about immigration. It's not about tax reform. It's not about Obama's a socialist. These are about their viewers literally taking their own lives at the behest of vaccinated hosts and everyone at Fox News not giving a damn and cheering the 25th anniversary. There was an interview with the CEO this week. She says she sleeps great at night. She doesn't have a concern in the world. She's spending those Murdoch paychecks, and everyone is overseeing a death cult for ratings. It's mind-boggling, but that is where this brainwashing movement has ended. Real quick, when you add a GOP party embracing authoritarianism, Fox News brainwashing, and a QAnon cult, that is a formula for a crumbling democracy, which we are seeing right now.
You know, the cynicism is key here that Eric mentions, Joan, and this is something I've been really struck by. I mean, but the combination of the cynicism and cowardice, right? So all of these hosts, Laura Ingraham and Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity, they go on and they peddle this vaccine misinformation and they rail against vaccine mandates. Their own company has one. They won't say a word.
We know that they are vaccinated.
Yes.
We know that they
and
are
very almost certainly vaccinated. But that cynicism is carrying on Roger Ailes' tradition. I want to read this quote because it jives with something you said, you wrote about your one meeting with him. So this is him from his memo to Nixon saying, people are lazy. With television, you just sit, watch, listen. The thinking is done for you. He had tremendous contempt for his audience. He kept it his whole life in the same way Donald Trump does. And he evinced it in the one meeting that you ever had with him.
He did. You know, he was like, Our viewers don't even want to know somebody like you exists. But he took a meeting with me and my bosses at Salon because he was kind of curious. I mean, I think he wanted to know that we existed and who we were. But it was just so amazingly cynical. And it was shocking how just on top of the world he was, and just convinced that we we would never get through to his audience. And he would never put us through to his audience. And I still feel to this day, like, I have no idea that we could have broken through, but it was just a warning. And I don't think I took it seriously enough at the time, Chris. I really don't. It was icky when I think back on it, but it was really, really a warning.
Yeah, and the control here is the only other thing that I'll say here is that they live in fear of losing their audience. That's the other thing. Like, there's control and there's monopoly, but because they don't have real competition the way that everyone else in the other areas of media does. Eric, we saw it a little bit with OAN and Newsmax and all the sort of election trutherism, where they started to get beat a little bit, and they will never let that happen. It doesn't matter how vile, how horrible, how wrong or flatly factually wrong it is. They will chase whatever it is that keeps them in possession of that audience.
Yeah, Hannity's ratings right after the election were a disaster. Hannity's ratings December and January, that audience was depressed pre-insurrection. And it looked like he was, you know, they were going to lose a big chunk of their audience. And as you said, I knew there was going to be a disaster. 2021, it was going to be a disaster for Fox in terms of the vile programming, because it's exactly what you said. They had never really had anyone kind of snipping at the heels. And there is no way they were ever going to be outflanked on the far right in a meaningful way by anybody. You go back and you look at the Fox coverage 5-10 days after Trump lost, there was kind of this, hey, let's move on. Hey, what's going on? By late December, January, all in, stolen election. What is going on? Democrats are stealing. They will never be outflanked, and they don't care what it takes. And Tucker Carlson is proving that he doesn't care how many of his viewers die as he pumps out, you know, anti-vaccine, anti-science during a public health crisis. This public health crisis should have ended in July. I mean, thousands of Republicans have just killed themselves since the vaccine to own the libs, as they call it at Fox News. I mean, it's just astonishing.
Joan, the other aspect of this, and this has been a through line, is they delight in punching down. They will pick some random freshman at some college who did something like burned a flag, or or Bill O'Reilly will bully the son of someone who lost their life in 9/11, or you know, Tucker Carlson will pick out some reporter, one of my colleagues, for instance. And the audience, when they put someone in their sights, like, it creates a security problem for that person. It is a cascade of abuse that's sort of unlike anything else in media.
It absolutely is. And I went through it when Bill O'Reilly took off after me. And I think it was, oh my God, it's like 10, 11 years ago, but it was terrifying. And their people are just really sad people who just want to go after the people that they think are doing them wrong. And I don't know that that's still happening, but I assume it is. And I do know that Tucker Carlson is sending his flying monkeys after a lot of people, whether it's, you know, about the great replacement theory, or it's about not getting your vaccine, which he got. We all know he got it. But it is still scary. I would like them to kind of shut it down.
I think it would be really wonderful for the country and the world if that happened. I doubt it will. Joan Walsh and Eric Bowler.
I'm a dreamer.
The deadline for the January 6th subpoenas has passed, and Steve Bannon is trying to dodge the committee by hiding behind Trump's executive privilege claim, a claim that was roundly and officially rejected by the White House today. So what happens now? What are the consequences for defying a congressional subpoena? Congressman Joe Neguse joins me on that next.
The International Rescue Committee works in more than 50 countries, serving people whose lives have been upended by war, conflict, and natural disasters. In places like Gaza, Ukraine, and Lebanon, displaced families are experiencing rough winter weather on top of war, hunger, and displacement. All of this has driven up food prices, destroyed infrastructure, and driven millions from their homes. Donations help the IRC provide families with resources like food, shelter, fuel, medicine, blankets, and cash assistance. Donate today by visiting rescue.org/rebuild.
Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
Donald Trump has been trying to use executive privilege to withhold documents from the January 6th Select Committee. Well, today, the Biden administration formally rejected that appeal, sending a letter to the National Archives saying, quote, the constitutional protections of executive privilege should not be used to shield from Congress or the public information that reflects a clear and apparent effort to subvert the Constitution itself. This comes after Trump encouraged four of his top aides to ignore the subpoenas recently issued by the committee. Now, according to the committee, two of those aides, former Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and former Pentagon aide Kash Patel, are, quote, engaging with the Select Committee. Politico reports that Deputy Chief of Staff for Communications Dan Scavino was served with his subpoena today. We told you that they hadn't gotten to do that yet. While Trump's former chief strategist Steve Bannon has, quote, indicated he will try to hide behind vague references to privileges of the former president, according to the committee. But today, the committee made clear there will be consequences for ignoring subpoenas. They write, quote, we will not allow any witness to defy a lawful subpoena or attempt to run out the clock, and we will swiftly consider advancing a criminal contempt of Congress referral. Meanwhile, other Democratic members of Congress are proposing legislation to fine witnesses up to $100,000 for defying congressional subpoenas. One of the members sponsoring this legislation is Congressman Joe Neguse, a Democrat from Colorado. He served as an impeachment manager in the second impeachment trial of Donald Trump, and he joins me now. There's a lot to digest here because there's a bunch of moving pieces. So let's start first with the White House's stepping in to say to the National Archives, There's nothing here. Go ahead. What does that mean? What's the legal impact and significance of that?
Well, good evening, Chris. It's good to be with you. Look, it's a big development. I think the White House made the right call and a prudent step forward to ultimately direct the National Archives to disregard any spurious claim of executive privilege, which, you know, I think would have been intellectually dishonest under these circumstances, given, as the White House said, what these documents purportedly may very well show, which is the subversion of the peaceful transfer of power and ultimately conduct that is clearly relevant to the events of January 6th. So I think it's an important step forward and obviously a sea change from, the spurious claims of executive privilege that we were become so accustomed to under the Trump administration from the White House.
Does this mean this may be an operational question that you don't have the answer to, but I'll ask it anyway. It's like it seems to me like they should just furnish it. And if they want to litigate post facto, fine. But there should be no delay here.
Yeah, I certainly agree with you with respect to the documents. I don't think that there's any question that that would be the logical step forward. And I suspect that the Select Committee is imploring the National Archives to do precisely that. We'll, of course, see whether or not litigation gets in the way.
OK, that brings us now to these four people who are defying the subpoenas as of now. Two of them engaged with the Select Committee. Two of them, Bannon and Scavino, basically just thumbing their nose at it. Bannon, I think, wrote a letter. Bannon is a particularly ridiculous case. He's not part of the executive. He was an unpaid advisor. He had received a pardon for a very serious charge of fraud that he was facing by the president. And the president is no longer the president, the guy that he was advising. There's like zero good faith executive privilege claim here. And the question, I guess, is, do you let him try to run out the clock in court?
The answer is no. I mean, look, I agree with you, Chris. Obviously, it's absurd and ridiculous, the letter that that Mr. Bannon's lawyer submitted to the Select Committee. It is consistent with the wholesale obstruction that we experienced and witnessed firsthand during the Trump administration. As you'll remember, you know, I was a member and still am a member of the House Judiciary Committee, and we saw the Trump administration play this exact same playbook time and time again as they stonewalled congressional investigations. But what has changed, of course, and what is different now is that The Department of Justice is, you know, obviously you have an attorney general at the head of the Department of Justice who I think cares a great deal about co-equal branches of government and separation of powers and ensuring that constitutional prerogatives of the Congress are respected. I mean, at the end of the day, if witnesses can defy subpoenas without consequence, then congressional oversight really no longer exists. And it's hard to make the case that Congress is a co-equal branch of government under in that circumstance. So, you know, I take very seriously the Select Committee's language that was in the press release today with respect to potentially pursuing criminal contempt of Congress, a referral to the Department of Justice, which, you know, we'll have to, time will tell as to whether or not the Department of Justice under Attorney General Garland will ultimately implement that referral and pursue it. But I and many of my colleagues also believe that we shouldn't wait for the Department of Justice and that we should pursue the inherent contempt powers of the Congress in the interim, which is something that the Congress can and should do.
What does that look like?
So inherent contempt powers of the Congress, Chris, have always existed under our Constitution. The powers have been largely dormant for the better part of the last 90 years. And myself, Ted Lieu, Val Demings, a group of us on the House Judiciary Committee, who, again, experienced the stonewalling of the Trump administration firsthand, a year and a half ago proposed changing our rules to essentially codify and authorize the use of inherent contempt. And inherent contempt would function very similar to the way in which criminal contempt of Congress functions if that referral is implemented. So a long-winded way of saying that essentially it would include fines, monetary penalties. And I should mention that in the past, inherent contempt has been used by the Congress in both the Senate and the House with penalties of imprisonment as well. The last time was during the Teapot Dome scandal of the 1930s. So Congress is not powerless. It would not require the passage of the resolution in the Senate, and it would only require a majority vote in the House of Representatives. So we think our resolution is a prudent step forward, and we'll certainly be encouraging our colleagues to take it up.
Wait, that's key. You wouldn't need the Senate, because when I saw this earlier today, I thought, like, obviously there's not going to be 10 Republican votes for this in the Senate. Your theory of the case here is that this would be a simple majority vote of a resolution adopting rules codified in the branch of the House itself, which derives the power from the U.S. Constitution.
That's precisely right. The implied powers under the Constitution that give the House and the Senate the ability to use its inherent contempt power to enforce duly authorized congressional subpoenas. So really, the resolution is simply codifying a set of procedures, right, that are required and that ultimately would survive constitutional scrutiny, as the Supreme Court has, you know, opined on this in the past. Look, the evisceration of congressional oversight really is nearing crisis levels, and it has for quite some time. And so, you know, implementing this resolution would put Congress back on the path, I think, of repairing the damage that has been done over the last several years under the Trump administration. I think it's a prudent step forward, and I'm hopeful that my colleagues will agree.
Well, if it comes to that and you have to send the Capitol Police out to find Steve Bannon, I would recommend you first search the nearest Chinese billionaire's yacht you can get your hands on. Congressman Joe Neguse, thank you very much.
Good to see you, Chris.
Up next, another edition of the worst drama on Capitol Hill, in which the junior senator from Texas once again doesn't even know what he's even talking about.
In the game of chicken, Chuck Schumer won this game of chicken. As two trucks drove towards each other on a country road, one or the other was going to turn, or you were going to have a lot of dead chickens.
Hey, everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.
On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, political experts, former Senator Claire McCaskill and Democratic strategist Jennifer Palmieri examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
The focus is on the voters that are not necessarily in your corner now.
If Democrats are going to win in 2024, we have to be able to explain what is happening at the border and what the solutions are.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Thursday.
I believe the end result of this game of chicken was clear. I believe Democratic leader Schumer was on the verge of surrendering. And then, unfortunately, yesterday, Republicans blinked. I think that was a mistake. I think that was the wrong decision. In the game of chicken, Chuck Schumer won this game of chicken. As two trucks drove towards each other on a country road, one or the other was going to turn, or you were going to have a lot of dead chickens. I wish Republicans hadn't blinked. We shouldn't have done that.
Wait a second. Wait a second. First of all, how many metaphors are we mixing in there? But second of all, more importantly, does Ted Cruz think the game of chicken is two trucks full of actual chickens driving towards each other? What movies has he been watching? Now, he does happen to be right about one thing. Minority Leader Mitch McConnell absolutely blinked, swerved, got out of the way, flinched in negotiations about whether or not to raise the debt ceiling and enable the U.S. to pay for things it had already purchased. Last night, 11 Republican senators, including McConnell, joined with Democrats to enable the passage of a bill to temporarily prevent the U.S. from defaulting on its payments, at least until December. Speaking today, President Joe Biden pointed to that agreement as a sign that things are getting done.
Turn on the news and every conversation is a confrontation. Every disagreement is a crisis. But when you take a step back and look at what's happening, we're actually making real progress. And thanks to bipartisan agreements, we're making progress on funding the government and raising the debt limit so people continue to get their Social Security checks, the military continues to get paid, and so much more.
Biden also spoke with Mitch McConnell today. Of course, shortly after that, McConnell released a letter to Biden saying Republicans would not support raising the debt limit when it comes up again in December. He's going to plow that truck full of chickens into the other chicken truck, and we'll see if Ted Cruz learns how a game of chicken works by then. But here's the thing. The Biden agenda is a lot more than just keeping the government open and funded, of course. There's a long way to go to getting his signature bills passed. For more on the status of the president's Build Back Better bill and the rest of the Biden agenda, I'm joined by Jared Bernstein, a member of Biden's White House Council of Economic Advisors. It's good to have you on, Jared. Let's start with today's jobs numbers, which came in far below what I think consensus estimates were. Unemployment sub 5%, which is encouraging, but 200,000 jobs. There was this idea that people are going to get vaccinated and everything's going to come roaring back. And it looked like that for a bit. And then we got Delta. Now, where are we in the recovery's trajectory?
Yeah, that's a great question. We are making progress. We're making solid progress. You started out with the unemployment rate. Oh, it came down from 5.2 to 4.8%. That's a big drop in 1 month. And that's the lowest it's been, first time below 5% since the pandemic hit. You know, a couple of years ago, the Congressional Budget Office looked at the pandemic-induced recession and thought that we wouldn't get to unemployment this low until 2023. That was before this president passed the American Rescue Plan. And this links right up to your question, Chris, because what did the rescue plan do? It got shots in arms, also checks in pockets. And that meant people could go back to work, they could re-engage with commerce, and that's why we've seen not only that drop in the unemployment rate, but 4.8 million jobs, an historical record since this president took office. So solid progress in the labor market. It's going to come in bips and bops and ups and downs and month to month. And you're right, Delta is still upon the land. But that's why the vaccination agenda is so important.
1 to 10, 10 being the very concerned, 1 being not concerned at all. How concerned are you about inflation?
Well, I'm always concerned about anything that's above average when we're talking about inflation. And so before the pandemic kicked in, we started having some of these supply chain transitory disruptions. Inflation was running at around 2%. And of course, it's been well north of that. The main thing, the way I think about this in terms of concern, though, is what do we expect to happen once these supply constraints constraints, once these bottlenecks unwind, and we begin to see a smoother flow of goods, of chips, of the kinds of goods that are flowing through our ports, but have seen, again, bottleneck conditions. We haven't forgotten how to make cars. We haven't forgotten how to produce and to import chips. In fact, one of the investments that's so important to the Biden administration is building a domestic capacity to beat some of these supply problems. Now, that's going to take a while, but that's a longer-term solution. And the consensus among economists is, in fact, that these disruptions are transitory. So every forecast is for inflation to start coming down in coming quarters. And that's the way I think about that scenario at this point.
There was a big announcement today that piqued my curiosity. The OECD has been working on essentially a global minimum corporate tax. So the idea is there's a race to the bottom. There are all kinds of countries that have essentially kind of used very, very low tax rates to attract not just business, but a lot of very shady, shady money hiding and laundering, frankly. Right. There's a deal now struck of a 15% global minimum. Is this real? Is my question. Like, is this going to be enforced? Is this a real thing we're looking at?
Yes, great question. It is real. It is a big deal. One reason I think you can attest to its reality is 136 countries just joined hands, representing 90% of global GDP, to take the global minimum tax from 0 to 15%. Now, why would all those different countries, some of which, by the way, have been pretty low tax havens themselves, why would they join hands and do this? Precisely for the reason you gave. They're tired. They're middle class, just like our middle class. Their leaders, just like Joe Biden, are tired of seeing countries book their profits in low tax havens, book their deductible expenses in higher tax countries, and come away with a level of profitability that robs their treasuries, just like ours, of $150 billion per year in revenue. So very real, very important, a big deal. You know, this is what Joe Biden calls foreign policy for the middle class, because it dampens the incentive to offshore jobs and production, and it brings revenues that should be back in America back to our coffers.
All right, Jared Bernstein, come by anytime for updates. Good to talk to you.
Thank you, Chris.
All right, still ahead. From Seattle to Scottsdale, from Boston to Boise, rent is going through the roof. Why prices are skyrocketing in America's cities, coming up. If you have ever seen the musical Hamilton or listened to the soundtrack, you know one of the people you cannot help but completely fall for is the Marquis de Lafayette. He raps at an insanely fast pace with a French accent. In fact, he holds the record for fastest Broadway rap, which I guess makes sense, clocked at 6.3 words per second at some points. The Marquis de Lafayette was originally played by the wildly talented David Diggs. I'm sure it's his image that pops into the heads of a lot of people right now if they hear the name Lafayette. But the real Marquis de Lafayette was a towering figure in both American history and French history, as is represented by the fact there is almost certainly something named after him where you live. There are dozens of American cities and towns named after Lafayette, countless parks and streets and plazas. In fact, the park just across the street from the White House is Lafayette Park, named after him. If you want to understand why that's the case, you can listen to this week's Why Is This Happening podcast interview with historian Mike Duncan. Mike has a great new book out about the Marquis de Lafayette called Hero of Two Worlds. And Duncan is also the host of one of my favorite podcasts in the world, the Revolutions podcast. So it was really, really a pleasure to talk to him about learning history, discussing history, and America's favorite fighting Frenchman. Check it out on this week's episode of With Pod, wherever you get your podcasts. Over the last year and a half throughout the pandemic, it's been hard to get a lot of things. Remember, back at the beginning of the pandemic, it was things like hand sanitizer, masks, toilet paper. Remember the images, rows and rows of empty store shelves, while every online retailer was sold out too. And then earlier this year, the big problem was computer chips. In fact, Jared Bernstein just referenced that. And that shortage slowed production of new cars, causing prices of used cars to skyrocket. Now the shortage everyone is talking about is in housing. This one has been a long time coming. According to the National Association of Realtors, of course, not exactly a disinterested party, but still, the U.S. has underbuilt its housing needs by at least 5.5 million units over the past 20 years, meaning we are 5.5 million houses short right now. This chart tracks the number of new homes being built since the year 2000, and you see that sharp downturn, bottoming out after the previous housing bubble in 2008, and the slow increase in the years since, but never making it back up to where it was before. So we've been left with a big housing supply problem. And now, in cities big and small around the country, the housing market has gone completely and utterly bonkers. In New York City, the return of many people to the city since the pandemic has sent rents into the stratosphere, up by about 70% compared to a couple months ago, according to a real estate broker. That is leading to some really, really nutty situations, like a line of 80 people to view a nearly $3,000 a month two-bedroom unit in Chelsea. In the suburbs of San Francisco, up to 80% of homes are selling above list price, often after wild bidding wars, like a recent sale that received 21 offers. In Boise, Idaho area, home prices are up nearly 40%, leaving out people like John Evans, who was born and raised there, but cannot afford the larger home his growing family is looking for. Quote, "I'm not in a position to make an all-cash, no-contingency offer, nor am I willing to go $100,000 over asking, which is what we're up against. Newbies are literally throwing money at everything, leaving guys like me in the dust." Diana Olick is CNBC's real estate correspondent. She's been covering this insane housing market, and she joins me now. It's great to have you, Diana. There's sort of, I think, some slightly different dynamics happening in the for sale and rental market. And I want to focus first on the rental market. What is going on broadly in the rental market in the United States, in cities particularly right now?
Well, thanks for having me, for one. But what's going on is something we've never seen in the rental market before, and that's bidding wars. That's usually relegated to the home buying market. But you're actually hearing from rental agents that you're seeing lines of people out the door, that they're coming in offering over asking price of rent, which is, that's just not normal. And we're also seeing people coming in saying, well, I've got better credit scores, or I can offer you more upfront plus a little bonus or something else. All things that we all used to see in the buying market, we're now seeing in the rental market, because rents are soaring for apartments way up. And in fact, we actually saw the largest occupancy, 250,000 people more getting apartments just from July to September. That is the largest single quarter of occupancy in apartments since the early 1990s. So that gives you an idea of just how crazy it is for rents.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that about the over asking thing, because I have now been hearing this from people. And my first thought was like, is that a thing that happens? Did I not know that this was a thing that happens? Like, and if people are asking, you know, giving over asking on a house, which is an investment, you can say, well, I think the value will ultimately exceed that, even though it's over asking, I'll make it back. But in rent, it's just like, that's just more money for the landlord like that. And this seems to be happening in a lot of places.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, as you say, when you rent, you're throwing the money out. You're getting what you're getting and you get nothing back. But what we're really seeing it is in the single family rental market. When you go to rent an apartment and it's listed in a major building by a company, that's going to be the rent that the rent is. You can't really offer over asking for that. Single family rentals, though, are huge right now because people want to live in the suburbs. They want the school districts. They want to get out of the cities during COVID. And single family rentals are just booming. And those are owned by single landlords. Some of them are large companies, but most of them are either mom and pop or small investors, and they're going to take whatever you're offering them.
Right. So, okay. So here's what I don't quite get. So there is a structural problem here, which is that particularly in large and growing metro areas, there has been an undersupply of housing. There's particularly in cities, I know, you know, affordable rental units particularly, but generally supply has not expanded as much as it should, and that pushes up prices. That's a structural issue. But what has happened in the past few months to make this happen now? Because it seems so acute, so specific, and so sharp.
Well, it's not really the past few months. We've been underbuilding, as you showed in your chart, for many years. And that was because after the great housing crash, the subprime mortgage crisis, when the builders just got slammed, they pulled back. They didn't want to build anything over than what they thought they could sell. And they've been slowly, very slowly climbing back. You ask the question, well, if there's so much demand and builders are getting so much demand, why aren't they just building as many houses as they possibly can? Go back to supply chain issues, labor right. issues, land issues, material costs. They cannot pencil. That is, they cannot build the types of houses that are in demand. That is that entry level, lower price, first time home buyer house. They can't afford to build that. They're not going to profit off of it. They can only build the step up level house or the luxury house. There's not quite as much demand for that. But even when they want to build that, they're coming up against so many issues for land, labor, materials, and those higher costs that they're actually, believe it or not, I mean, they are pulling back on selling, which sounds crazy in a market where you have so much demand. They are pulling back on how much they will sell right now because they are afraid they just can't deliver it.
Right. So that you've got So you've got the actual supply chain issues that are affecting all different parts of the economy are applying the pertain to the new housing market too. But it also seems like, I guess I wonder how much. I guess there's not much slack in these rental markets anyway when they're normally operating, and so fairly small changes around the margins. I mean, that was the thing we saw with toilet paper, right? It was like, it didn't take a ton of change in consumer behavior at the margin to create like fairly catastrophic consequences. And I imagine it's something similar with how the rental market usually functions and usually clears and what the normal band of essentially vacancy there is.
Well, you have to remember, A, in a house is not as easy as a roll of toilet paper, right? But when you're talking about apartments, also remember, we've had an eviction moratorium going on for over a year now. That meant that people who could not pay the rent could not be evicted. It also meant that people for other reasons who couldn't pay the rent, maybe it wasn't COVID, could not be evicted. You have this regular cycle of apartments of people moving out, cycling through, and they just weren't moving at all. Maybe it was the rent. Maybe it was because they had nowhere else to go. Also, they couldn't move up to buy a house because housing got so expensive, they were just staying put. So that normal right. cycle that you're talking about of people coming yep. in and people going out is just not happening the way it would in a regular year.
Yeah. Yeah. So you've got the normal back, you got sort of a backlog. I mean, I'll personally editorialize and say I'm glad people weren't evicted during a pandemic, but you've got this backlog that ends up creating this situation now. It's gonna be really interesting to see where this goes next. Diana Olek, who's been covering this, thank you so much. That does it for All In. You can catch us every weeknight at 8 o'clock on MSNBC. Don't forget to like us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/allinwithchris.
Get the best of MSNBC all in one place every day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning in your inbox, you'll find expert analysis, video highlights of your favorite shows.
Running for re-election is when you actually get your report card from the American people.
Previews from our podcasts and documentaries, as well as written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves. Understand today's news. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.